We're on the home stretch. The last chapter in the book, well, there's a smattering of appendices, final words, concluding remarks, and other things that I don't know whether they count as chapters or whether they're optional. For example, I don't know if most people read the preface to a book or if a lot of people skip that or the acknowledgments. These are optional things, and it's only the OCD people that read every word in the book, maybe. I don't know. We will probably, just to give everybody a heads up, what we'll probably do or what we plan to do is we'll cover chapter 11 today, talk about that a bit. I say this every week, or at least I think it every week. I don't think we'll actually be quite as long today. We may get out a little early, we'll see. And then next week we'll conclude with a discussion time and kind of feedback time and application time, that kind of thing. And we may look a little bit at that point at this kind of appendix, a final word, the most important step. We'll kind of incorporate some of that. And then that'll be it for this study. So today we're in chapter 11, on your mark, get set, go. And the initial thoughts were just two. List the different communities in which your church or ministry and any organization with which they partner are working. Which of these communities are considered to be materially poor? Which of these communities, those communities are not materially poor, but contain individual households that are materially poor? Let me pull up my list while you're getting your list. Which communities are we?
Stillwater.
Okay. Certainly in the Stillwater area then. Did everybody write down Stillwater as their number one thing, if you wrote anything down? So we definitely have different things going on here in Stillwater, including a ministry we partner heavily with, Stillwater Life Services, ministering in Stillwater and surrounding areas. And they're... most of us probably would not consider Stillwater to be a materially poor community. I would think it probably fits this. You're welcome to disagree or offer food for thought here, but it seems like it fits that second description, that there's a mix. There are households that are materially poor, but it's not marked as, it's not just widespread poverty the way we might find in Sudan or something. Did I just give away one of my other ones on the list? I wrote down Sudan, where our denomination has work going on there. So we have. As individuals, we have maybe connections there through prayer, financial gifts, that sort of thing. But other places, are we having, or maybe having an impact? There you go. Japan. Certain nations in East Asia, yeah. And I even wrote down, I got that one. I got those two. And then Ireland and Scotland, we certainly have congregations there who are trying to kind of revive that area, till that soil. Covering a lot of the earth here. I mean, that's a good start. We have other communities, right, with our individual congregations. We have rural communities. We have urban communities, mostly rural or small towns, but I guess we have a few congregations in some fairly large cities, and new works that are starting up in some, like Dallas, for example, and Bryan College Station. I've never actually been there, but it's a large, I guess Bryan is, it's all connected, right? So it's essentially a large community city. Okay. Of all the ones that we mentioned, I thought... that Sudan, from what I've seen anyway, Sudan is probably the most materially poor, or one that we would characterize as pretty much widespread material poverty. Most of the other communities are a mix, kind of like ours. Maybe East Asia, depending. There might be large areas of fairly widespread poverty, but it seems like in most cases it's that mixture with households who are mixed in. have a lot of material poverty, whereas others do not. So I admit that I got, I don't know if you had this happen, but they're always trying to trip you up with this, with the questions at the beginning. They want you to write something down or say something so that later you can be proven wrong. But I'm okay with that. At least I think I'm okay with that. And I was, this happened to me on number two, well, sort of. Did you consider, first of all, do these other, if we're partnering with other organizations, do they appreciate our help? And how do you know they appreciate our help?
They've asked for it.
That's a key one there. Maybe they've asked for it and a certain kind of help, and we've responded with that kind of help. I had an example of this I'll share in a minute. But yeah, that's a more encouraging, less risky way to help without perhaps doing the wrong thing or not being helpful in a certain way. I wrote down that I think they do, because they say thanks. They say they appreciate it. And then, of course, I was interested in the chapter where the church was helping in a certain way they'd insisted on and kind of being thanked for it, only to find out it really wasn't helping. So I thought, well, okay. Just because you're thanked doesn't necessarily mean it's good. But I like the idea of if we'd been asked to help in a certain way. It's funny because there's a potential service opportunity coming up with an organization here in town, not Still Water Life Services, but another one. I may have some more words about it coming soon. I'm trying to evaluate. Of course, it happens on an evening when I'm going to be gone. And I was in the middle of reading this chapter, so I fired off an email to the fellow and said, "Hey, are you sure that you need volunteers for this?" And to my amazement, he responded real quickly. He must have been on his email at that moment. He said, "Yeah." I don't remember exactly how the conversation went. And I said, "By the way, have you read When Helping Hurts?" And that's all I said, and I thought, if he has read it, he might... I don't know how he'll take that. So he immediately responded and said, "Yes, I have. Why do you ask?" And I thought, okay, I'll explain, because he might think, am I about to say, well, what you're doing may not be helping? And I said, no. So I responded and I said, well, I wanted to make sure that we were helping in a way you needed, because I'm just now reading a paragraph where a church was helping in a way that wasn't exactly needed. But I was kind of like Liz just said. I said, one good thing here was that you're kind of telling us how you need help, so I feel more comfortable that we're probably helping in the way you need. You kind of said you needed this. So. Didn't want to assume, though, that I wasn't kind of saying, well, here, we want to contribute this way, or maybe we can volunteer, and only to find out, like the example given, that wasn't really helping. Okay, so speaking of that, let's get into it. We have Jerry, Dan, and the rest of Parkview's leadership team. This is this church that's a pretty common sort of congregation. They're in a suburban, more or less a suburban environment. They're not far away from a bunch of material poverty, but their church is fairly affluent. I mean, it's a church where there aren't a lot of very materially poor people. A lot of white people there, for example, and this happens a lot. We know a lot of congregations aren't, some are, but tend to be often kind of a similar ethnic makeup. Various reasons for that, but that tends to happen. And so they were in this story that was given, and I got the impression. Maybe you did too, that this is a true story. I don't think this was fiction, right? I think he had said that earlier on, that this isn't just an example of what could happen, but is essentially something that has happened. I don't know if the names have been changed or not, but here's the pastor there, or not pastor, these ministerial leaders who are trying to follow up and discover that they've not been very helpful. Give me just a second here. I couldn't help but think, I don't know if anybody else did this, but I couldn't help but think of the example that Meg gave, you know, where here's a church. It sounded like it was right out of the same. I mean, I thought she wrote this for a second. You know, church is saying, but we want, you know, we insist on giving Christmas gifts. We want to do it this way. And here's somebody who says, well, we have a way that will minister better to the people we're trying to help. but the church wants to help in the way they want to help, and wants to have that return on investment feel, I guess. We helped this many. And again, I know at this point we've kind of beat this horse to the death here, but it's good to want to help people, and it's good to have measurable results and so on. But one thing that I'm taking away, especially at the end of this study in these final chapters, is a reminder that the ROI that we'll see is often not the ROI that business-leaning North Americans like. Quantify this many families helped in a certain way out of this certain level. When you're doing relationship building, which tends to be by far the most effective way to help people, it's hard to show it on a bar chart. Not that I'm against bar charts, but we know that we want to have measurable results. It's always good. This kind of management 101, you have to have something measurable. You have to have a time frame on it. And that usually works very well. I don't know about you, but I've seen a lot of goals in groups, either from business or something else, where that's not done. And it's just kind of open-ended. And it doesn't work well. People get off track. You never really get anywhere. So I can see that it is a good thing to have measurable results. But we still continue to find that a lot of time, and you can have measurable results, I guess, in relationship building. But I just keep coming back to how difficult it is to get your sink your teeth into a program where they're wanting to build relationships, and it may take a few years. And I know a couple of missionaries and people that we're involved with where I admit that up until recently I was kind of having a hard time, not that I didn't support what they were doing, but I just was kind of having a hard time really figuring out what they were doing. I think it's good, but I don't really know if this is helping, you know, what it's helping. And now I'm starting to think it's probably more helpful than any several of the other ministries that I've thought were more objectively helping people, because these are the ones I'm thinking of are pretty relationship oriented. They're kind of infiltrating in certain ways, trying to build relationships with people. I know one who is a sports chaplain. He goes and runs, does marathons and triathlons and such, and gets in with all these people that do that, and they work out, and they're kind of fitness buffs and everything, So that was one that came to mind. I thought that that's a way that they get into kind of the inner circle with these. Now, that's not necessarily a materially poor community, but it's a community. Yeah, he's essentially a kind of a missionary to it's domestic. He's here. It's in Colorado now. And this guy I went to high school with. Hope he's not listening to the recording. Probably not. I won't say by name. He was a really good pitcher back in high school. He could bring the heat. But anyway,
he.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and that's where, and I think that's there. That's where I've kind of not been able to tell real well. I think it's part of, you know, I wonder, is it part of a sending organization, or is it just, I'm going to go out and do this thing, will you support me? I don't think it's that, but it's definitely necessary to still have accountability and such. But I remember, or I've been seeing how my perspective is changing a bit as I see, it's not, again, that's a little bit different because it's not, he's not necessarily working with poverty alleviation. It's just trying to reach a different group of people. Some of them might even be more affluent. I don't know. People who do that, you know, might have apparently some disposable time, or I think those things cost money that they do. You know, and if they're training a certain way, they're probably spending money on that. So, but again, it's about relationship building. We've got others that we know who are going to do that. So anyway, the time frames tend to be longer, and we'll especially talk about that when we think of ministry overseas. So anyway, we'll kind of work through real briefly here. I don't think we'll go into too much depth, but this last chapter had a few different models or ideas for how you might partner. I think we can take a little bit out of this, see what your thoughts are. The way they divided this up, or what I focused on anyway, was three main kind of. There was a fourth that I just didn't really focus on as much. Prongs here. Directly working at the household level in North America, working with households directly. Or the second one was partnering for development in materially poor communities in North America. And then the third one was partnering for development in materially poor communities in the majority world. By the way, have you noticed that they say they specifically don't want to say third world. They say majority world. And I've wondered, is this semantics here? But I think their point is, in case it wasn't clear, probably was clear to everybody, that more people, there are a lot more people there than here. I was reminded how actually the RPCNA is the minority. The North American contingent of the RPCNA is now becoming the minority, given certain acquisitions, if you will, overseas. I think it's kind of exciting. But we're the little guys. They outnumber us by quite a bit. So we should keep that in mind. So directly working at the household level in North America, I realize some of these things, they're hearkening back to a lot that we've done earlier. They said, well, if we're going to work directly with households, and we might think about this, how in our congregation, if we're partnering to directly help any households here in the community, it's good to do a few things. They had four kind of main headings under this. First, assess and mobilize the gifts of the church or organization. So we might start with ourselves, kind of consider, okay, what can we do? What gifts and talents do we have? Math and engineering, first of all, seem to be talents. I think our defense and special teams are pretty good, but I don't know. We may need some help on offense. Know the gifts, abilities, and resources present and available in the congregation. And I made that bold font, so that must mean it's important. Available. This reminds me of something we've been thinking about at Still Our Life Services, the need for passionate and available people. You really have to have both. Because we may have a bunch of gifts in the congregation here, but we may not be available. So we have to be realistic, and this is not the time where I start putting a guilt trip on everybody and making everybody feel guilty of whether we should reorient our lives or something. Maybe, I don't know. It does come down to availability, and so we have a lot. We have families. We're doing a lot of things, and so we want to be realistic about the availability of our different resources and gifts. And we all might want to consider as individuals our priorities. Again, I'm not here to put anybody on the spot, especially you, Jonathan Mounts. No, I'm just kidding. He's sitting front and center, so he's got to get picked on. Sam, okay? You know who I'm talking to here, Sam. Now, I'm not putting anybody on the spot, but we all might want to consider, you know, where our priorities are. I've been thinking about this myself. We have lots of things that we're doing. And going back to the earlier chapter, we're thinking about how near and dear this is to God's will and His church growth plan and so on. So as we're thinking through our availability, that's going to be important. We also want to watch out for weaknesses that might hinder. So we have different strengths, but we also have weaknesses. And so we want to consider how those things may be in the mix as well and how they might hinder. They did have a tool. Won't focus on this. We'll talk about it here in a little bit for assessing our gifts as a congregation and what we can do. I don't want to say too much now because we're still considering this, but even Logan and I had been thinking earlier on, this was a couple years ago, we've been wanting to do this kind of preview maybe of some things we might be able to work on. Just really take inventory, make sure that we have a good kind of objective list or a grouping of things that we're able to do as a congregation, and things that we're also available, kind of just see where our gifts are and get somebody who needs help with. Back in a previous chapter when they were talking, doing that asset-based development, and they were going into the project, they get in this guy ends up in the living room talking to these folks who are saying, hey, we can fix cars, we can do this. Well, there you go. If we had a mechanic in our midst, we might know that if somebody's having car trouble, either within the congregation or coming outside, it'd be nice to know we've got somebody like that. We're a small enough congregation that, I don't know, I think we know each other pretty well. Probably have a decent idea of what each other's gifts are, but I don't know that we always have a great idea about that. I might not realize a number of things that y'all can do, and I might not realize a number of things that you're interested in doing, because we just don't necessarily talk about it very much. So be sure to come back next week. There might be things that you're interested in doing that I never would have guessed. and we might be able to use those things. So they have a tool as well that they suggest, a questionnaire to help us list our gifts and abilities. If you're able to, if you can run a 4.240 and you want to be able to be a starting wide receiver or something, we can work on that, Sam. That's what you can list anything for your gifts. Ultimate frisbee counts. There you go. And so, first thing they suggested, and it's I think a good idea, is for us to consider gifts and abilities within the congregation and availability of those things. Next, they talked about learning about existing organizations and services in the area. I think we've talked about this some already, and we don't want to reinvent the wheel. I don't think so far we've been reinventing any wheels. This has been something, by the way, that is, I think Stillwater as a community is doing a pretty good job of compared to a lot of communities. And I've been hearing this as good feedback as well. This collaborative effort, Stillwater Cares, that a lot of you have heard about, was brought into being by a lot of different organizations starting to work together. Churches actually talking to one another. This is rare, unfortunately, and that's not a good thing, in my opinion. When the people see that the churches aren't even talking to each other, and we have some doctrinal differences and so on, and I realize that can sometimes bear a troubling testimony to the world, but when we're not really working together, we duplicate efforts, perhaps unnecessarily. We might be inefficient, and I think the Stillwater area has been pretty good about trying to figure out who's doing what. We do have a number of groups that kind of do similar things. I'm sure that, you know, there's several food pantries in town. There's probably several kind of groups that do similar things, and that's not necessarily bad, but we're also trying to not have a lot of effort, because you lose enough with overhead doing the same sorts of things. So I think as a congregation we have good tools available to us to hopefully not reinvent the wheel too many times here in town. So it's good to learn about those existing organizations and services. I guess you don't have to name names, or you can. I can cover the. Does anybody think of any that seem like any services in the area that are being either that are being missed? We'll take a tangent here for a minute. Either major kinds of things that are not being offered in the community. This kind of hints ahead toward maybe things we should think about, or conversely, ones that are being duplicated, where it seems like we have too many people doing this or that thing. Can you think of any examples, kind of on the extremes of either side? Okay.
To school.
Okay.
So if we were voting for more money to improve transportation, whether that would be a bigger circle of a bus route or better sidewalks or things like that, that would be appropriate.
That's a good one. Okay. So there may be, it's possible there's a gap here in transportation, low-cost transportation. We've encountered this situation, or may have even been given earlier in the book. You've got maybe a person who is able-bodied, wants to work, doesn't have a car, has a hard time getting transportation, and especially if it's in a community where it's hard to walk from end to end. Stillwater could be that way. And so it has a hard time getting a job, but needs a job to get a car. Needs a car to get a job, needs a job to get a car. That's a bad thing. So one opportunity, I think, this was a while ago, what might be we provide some transportation, but here's a more systemic sort of view of saying, okay, how can the community potentially offer some resources to help get people get around?
Oh, they always have a fleet of bikes, I think, that's available, and I know like Wings of Hope also has bikes available.
Okay. It could definitely be a mix, right? There could be some people who, if you look at China or lots of other places, they bike all over the place. It's fine. It's good for you. We have many in the congregation who do
that.
Right. So you have some situations where somebody might be encouraged to say, you know, it's fine. You can do this, and it's not the end of the world to have to ride your bike. But there are other situations where there might be some constraints where motorized transportation would be more appropriate.
Effort to work with them, like keeping their bikes in good repair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, you know, making sure that they have an adequate number of bikes. You know,
yeah.
So, you know, very small, simple, practical things like that.
I wonder if anybody has a, like a, I don't know if I've heard of one, there might be like a carpooling network. Like, say you have a job or you have somebody who needs help getting to work, there might be somebody who's in the area either that could offer to take that person each day, maybe on the way to, I'm going here, I can pick you up each day, or kind of just help a network of private individuals that could offer almost our private bus service, connecting people. I wonder if anybody, I haven't heard of anything like that. I don't know if that would be appropriate or not in town.
Actually, in Oklahoma City, there was a news story about that. I don't know if anyone saw it, where it's a private company. I think they started out in Chicago, where they're sort of bypassing taxi and limousine services that they just offer in sort of private transportation for anyone that wants it for any need.
Okay.
And so there was a story on Channel 4 about it that, of course, the taxi drivers and the limousine, they're all saying, well, they haven't gone through the proper licensing. You know, there's a bureaucratic thing that if you're going to be transporting and, you know, the liability issues and all that sort of thing. And so, you know, they were arguing, well, this company's not doing it, but that's what they've done. It's just a private company. They've gone out and they said, look, if anybody wants transport for, you know, call 475-9186 and we'll get you set up.
Interesting. So you may run into regulatory barriers or something. At what point are you becoming a taxi service or something?
What I thought is that this company, they're national. I think they're in about a dozen cities now, Oklahoma City being one of them. So I can't remember the name of them, but if there's any way to kind of see, you know, what they do and how they do it and how they arrange things, I mean, that might be
one to look at.
Thought, you know.
Do you remember from? I didn't see the story. Do they, if you get a ride through them, are you getting a ride through an employee of them, or are they just connecting you with Sam because he's going that way and he'll take you?
Well, the way they set it up is that they take on their web. They take anyone who says they're willing to be a driver.
Okay. So
now, of course, they do a background check on them and they do all that sort of thing.
Okay.
You know? But if they feel like they're a competent driver, then like if I did it, they said, hey, there's someone over on, you know, Northwest 78th who needs to be taken to the store or something, then, you know, then I would go do it.
Okay.
Now, of course, they charge a fee for it, but it's far less than what it would be, you know, for a taxi or a limousine service.
Yeah.
You know?
Interesting.
But yeah, they just sort of arrange this private network, and what they do, everything comes in through the web, and so the web acts as a dispatch.
Yeah.
And then they get it out.
Well, that's kind of what I was thinking. Is that, you know, if you had could take administrative overhead to hopefully close to nil and just connect people directly. There's some risk there, though, too. There's some risks to work out, you know, abusers or predators or any. I mean, there's on the negative side, I could think of several things. But anyway, just thinking through this notion of, okay, we need to get people from point A to point B. What's the city infrastructure like? Even in Manhattan, and I don't mean Kansas, you can ride the subway, but that costs money, too. So they have a transportation system there that nobody drives. At least I don't think they do. Yeah, yeah. Once you get in there, you can't. I remember one time when we first got the first time I'd ever been there. I said, "Well, I don't want to drive in town. That's for sure." Next thing I knew, and we had this on camera. Right? Remember that? I was in the middle of town in the car driving because we had to get to our destination. I thought, well, so much for that plan, because I'm right in the middle of town driving this car thinking, okay, every other car in this street is yellow, except mine. And it worked out. But even there, you know, it costs money. I guess maybe people somehow work it out. So transportation could be one thing. That's good. In town, any other? You know, I'm not looking to necessarily criticize. I'm just trying to think through, are there any services that are really being duplicated too many times? You know, we have individual congregations and people doing several, maybe, of the same things, but I don't get the impression there's a lot of duplication of major
Dan, are you Thanks. Including duplication that leads to abuse in the sense of some people going from congregation to congregation?
Well, we could include that. So people calling just for, I need help paying the electric bill, right? You get that call. Need help this month paying my electric bill. And a lot of churches will directly help that. And so if there's not help available, we know there are lots of people. This happens a lot, and they just go down the list until somebody's able to do that. So,
the Salvation Army has a food pantry.
Okay.
And I think there are other churches, Hillcrest at one time. And you do wonder if people, I mean, I know in Garfield, people quickly learn who gets out food and
right.
just go from place to place.
Yeah.
And quite often they sold it. So,
Yeah.
That came with relationships too. But I don't know. I haven't heard a lot of other outreach in that sense.
I haven't. I only know of, just a small number. There might be individual congregations that do a little bit, but I think it's just kind of a few, which might help. And then,
where the food goes from the Big Harvest organization that takes canned goods this time of year, what do they do with it?
That's right. Goes on eBay. Cowboys with Compassion is, we've had before, I don't know if that's one you're talking about, but there's the trash bins that we've donated to. So they do a direct food distribution. In fact, they have a distribution coming up. And well, actually they do regular food distribution night, and then they also have a holiday meal and service and such for people. So I know there's one that does it, fairly large food bank, and then I think they now partner with Hillcrest. It may be, I'm not sure about this, but I think maybe Hillcrest is kind of combined with that, or at least for this one event. I think they host it and so on, so I think they're kind of joining forces. Stillwater Cares is a group that is kind of helping. One of the primary needs, or one, I think the primary reason that Stillwater Cares came about, it's not a direct organization trying to help people, it's just trying to help coordinate the helpers, because people call from place to place, and the number one need identified when they were asking people 4 years ago to identify what needs we have is a common screening process. That's what everybody's talked about, is guy comes, he needs help, turns out he's been to every other church, he gives a different story each time, and that hurts him, it hurts the organizations trying to help him, and it hurts the legitimate people who, you know, he may or may not have a legitimate need, he may have other issues, and then there are other people who fall between the cracks because it's easy to suspect everybody then, have a suspicious eye, and there might be a legitimate people who aren't doing that, but they kind of get a cynical view toward him. So it was designed to try to help him not be able to do that very easily, and we all can coordinate through us.
So obviously what we need is a web app, mobile app, multiple platform app, database application.
And they have introduced one, finally. Yeah, they have there's a service that does kind of a case management system that they're trying to get a lot of organizations to participate in, to finally have some software identified, or just a way, and there's privacy issues and so on, just trying to figure out how do we do this with it being a loosely coupled organizations doing their own thing. We don't have oversight over those organizations yet. We want everybody to plug into this thing, so they're working through trying to do that, just so that we can know who's already talking to this person. And the big challenge just being that it's not like we have four congregations. If we had four RP congregations in town, and maybe we're all pretty tightly coupled and tightly organized, we might have a different way of coordinating with each other than when we have groups that are different, may have certain differences among them. They're willing to work together, but there's certainly nobody has authority one over another. And so then how do you organize them and get them to want to participate so that we can eliminate some of these problems? Kind of a challenge. That was all under learning about the existing organizations and services in the area, avoiding reinventing the wheel. And then they had a restatement of the notion of adopting asset-based participatory is your word for the day. First encounter policies. So they mentioned that churches need to have a kind of a policy and procedure in place. What do we do when we get a call from somebody who needs help with the electric bill and so on? They have some guides for that. Move toward deeper engagement. And they had some suggestions, too, on helping assess whether a person is... Does the person really need relief, rehabilitation, or development? A lot of times we focus on relief. That may not be what's needed. In fact, I've made the case throughout the entire book that that's usually not what's needed, actually. We do it 90% of the time, and actually 90% of the time it's not what's needed. So there's only maybe, what, a 10%... Okay, so you have set A and you have set B. Help me here, Alan. You have set A and set B. We have the intersection of those two are the number of people who are actually going to need relief and we are ready to apply relief. That intersection, that is going to be, I almost said union, no, that would be wrong, is going to be much smaller than we would think. Are they receptive? Are they open to ongoing supportive relationships? We found it's often true that people are not necessarily receptive to that. They just want help with the electric bill, and when you try to go deeper with them, they might kind of reject that. And they made the point that in that case, that person is really rejecting help. They had a suggestion for some tools and things available. We're not going to go into this right now, from Diaconal Ministries Canada. I thought, wow. I feel like when they said, Nazareth, can anything good come from there about Jesus? We might say, Canada. Can anything good come from Canada? Well, we have hockey. That came from Canada. And they just mentioned that the point of these policies is to engage the person in guided conversation to better understand where they really are, kind of come up with a better plan of what to do. And they mentioned, again, if a life-changing crisis is not in play, there's nobody's lives in danger here, and the person is not willing to engage in an active plan of something constructive, then that person is the one refusing the help, not us. It's important to remember when we're trying to engage and help somebody, and we're not just putting up a whole lot of steps and barriers here, jump through this hoop, now this hoop, now this hoop. It's not that. When we're trying to engage somebody and the person does not want to be engaged or helped, it's that person who is effectively saying, I don't want to be helped. And just because a person asks for this thing, if it turns out that's not what the person needs, and you're trying to engage and help the person more, that person is the one making the decision to walk away. So that might help us when we're struggling with that. There was a table in the book. They had several so they went through the same principles of that we went through in the last chapter of a trigger, something that might trigger somebody to want to actually change, working through how that person might come in, mobilizing supportive people. They did mention when we're having mentoring relationships, if possible, it's always good to maybe have a group. Not that we couldn't have one-on-one mentoring or one family in our congregation mentoring somebody, but it's nice when we have support system. Especially if it's a real needy person, it just can be a lot of effort. It's taxing. And so it's nice when we have a circle of people to help. Or, and the final one here was explore the possibility of starting a new ministry. If there are gaps in the community, maybe a new ministry is needed. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel, but if it turns out there aren't any wheels, and actually, speaking of not having wheels, that's the one we were literally talking about. Maybe there's a lack of wheels in the community. And if so, how could we address that need? I like their perspective to outsource where the church adds no value. Sometimes people really struggle with this. I've been learning this over time, just again, even in business. Where do we just... Groups can oftentimes spend a lot of effort, energy, money, just mental effort, doing things that add no value to what they're doing. It would be much better to just hire that out and consider, what do I really do that adds value? And the other little things might be worth just somebody else can do those for me so I can keep my efforts focused on what adds value. That's not always easy to figure out. I've seen, even in business, a lot of people who want to do all kinds of things, And they end up spending a whole lot of effort on these things that are just... Let me give you a silly example, like your shoes. Couldn't you have potentially saved a lot of money by making your own shoes? Right? Especially if you're one of these kind of compound homesteader types or something, real self-sufficient. Make your own shoes, sew your own clothes. Not that I'm against, I'm not saying it's bad to sew your own clothes, I'm just saying all of your stuff, maybe you could have saved money by doing that, I don't know. Well, it turns out in most cases, no. It's a lot cheaper in the end, excuse me, you've outsourced that. In most cases, you bought the shoes, or you might have been given them by somebody. But you don't really think about doing that, or generating your own power. It's good to have maybe a generator if you have a storm or something, but we buy power. It's not worth our effort to do that, so we can focus on other things. But oftentimes, groups will want to do the same sort of thing in what they're doing, where they're really doing spending a lot of time on nitty-gritty that could potentially be outsourced. So even in thinking about the possibility of starting a new ministry, you want to outsource where the church adds doesn't necessarily add value, but watch out for, I think they use this term, secular subcontracting. So depending on who we partner with, you do get groups where they might be doing certain aspects of it, but they don't have a gospel focus. So we want to be careful about. And I think they wanted to, at one point, they kind of wanted to avoid engaging this topic too much because I guess it probably gets pretty lively. I'm sure they have some readers who just say, you really should never partner with anybody who's secular. This is a church effort. And others who'd say, no, it's good for certain services. You can get that done, but keep the others. I'm sure it gets lively, but they didn't really want to engage that too much, I think, to avoid offending either side too much. But we know that we want the gospel to be front and center and whatever we're trying to do. We know that nobody can truly change, even if a person stops being an alcoholic. There are lots of people who have defeated essentially alcoholism in a secular fashion. But I think all of us would agree that that's not the end goal. So that true life-changing ministry comes through the gospel.
Dana,
yeah.
Business of outsourcing, that does. It does remind me of the whole issue of productive use of time and so on. When I hear things like ministries that work on cars, I think, well, I don't work on my own car, I don't have time.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's something I, when I was younger, I didn't do it. When I was younger, I might have thought making my own shoes was a good idea.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, it does make me wonder about how we should use our, how we should use our time and whether a lot of things that are mentioned are really good uses of time.
That's a tough question.
Or maybe they're not a good use of time for some people.
This happens to me on a daily basis almost when I'll sit there and think, okay, I'm faced with a certain challenge in the household. Or at work or something, and used to be, and I even had this conversation recently with a fellow who just, he grew up on a farm. They did everything. You didn't have anybody to call, so they were very resourceful, very knowledgeable, and in the context I was having this conversation, you could see how, this is one of these gentlemen who knows everything. I mean, he could fix your tractor, he could drive your horse team, he could program your computer. And he actually, because he used to work for IBM, he actually could do all those things. You just wonder, where do these people come from? He just knows everything. And that's very admirable. But even then I was thinking through, to bring it back to myself, I'll sit there and think, well, I could potentially solve this problem myself, and it may take me this amount of time. Is that the best use of my time? Well, I know I don't want to spend the money to hire, say, a plumber to come. I don't want to spend the money on that. And it's not always clear. Well, is it a better use of time and resources to get that done so that I can accomplish these other tasks? It's not always clear. And, I could easily make a decision where I do it this way, and somebody might have a good case to say, well, you probably could have spent your time better this way. Vice versa. It's just, I think there's a legitimate case to be made at times for, outsourcing. I know I've outsourced recently some work that, in my case, I mean, to give a straight example, I could potentially, I'll do certain work I do, I bill clients by the hour. Well, if I got 2 hours of billable time in, it might more than pay for the cost of the plumber who came. If it took me 4 hours to do a job he can do in an hour, I pay him his hourly rate, and I billed 4 hours to my client, I made a profit. It's not always that clear, but... And I don't know where it sometimes will border, though. I think I might use that as an excuse at times. I know I'll do this. I don't know about you. Me being a sinner, I know nobody else here is. I'll use this as an excuse to sometimes avoid jobs I just don't want to do. And you know, maybe I should do them, but I'll just say, well, this is really a better use of my time, and it might be, and I've thought about this, well, am I just trying to be lazy? Or am I just not wanting to do this, to bite the bullet and do some work that's less appealing to me, so I'm going to, I don't know. But it definitely, a lot of people will spend time, you know, in maybe not the wisest way when it would have been good to just outsource it. Yeah. Right? Yeah, it is. A hobby form or something.
Trying to think in terms of what Stillwater Life Services does. There's a lot of places in Stillwater where you can go and get really inexpensively the same sort of services they provide. But it's the intentional relationships that you're looking for.
Yeah.
That enable plant all of a sudden have an atmosphere where they can hear the gospel. In a situation where they're accepted. Yeah. And that's huge. That's what we're looking for in a lot of these job prepared, this kind of ministries, or child's ministries, children's ministries, or something. We're looking for that sweet moment where someone is really open to the gospel. In which, you know, their lives can really be transformed in a huge sort of exponential manner rather than a kind of incremental manner in which they're not ushered into the kingdom of God.
Yeah.
We're not really there to be a family.
Yeah. Yeah.
Back to this question of what ministries aren't being done and so on. What about facilitating the informal labor market? So, I mean, this comes to mind because in our discussion of what we have time to do and so on. If I wanted to hire someone to help me haul in firewood, you know, there's nowhere to go.
Yeah.
What about those people who actually have, you know, time and so on? Is there, in some cities, I understand, there's places where people go and contractors come pick them up and take them out for day labor.
Okay. We have so there's like a formal, there's organizations for a fee that do that, like Express here in town, but these are ones that are kind of more what I call guerrilla, not gorilla like the animal, but guerrilla like, okay. Grassroots sign up where people could do that. You know, and even in thinking about that, this notion of gleaning or of leaving the corners of your field unharvested, the idea there in the Old Testament, right, was to you leave some of that. Don't harvest all the way to the corner, just to let some of the poor come and get that, and they would work for it. And we certainly know Ruth, right, the story of Ruth and how hard she was working at that. So here's the situation, going back to what you were saying earlier, Jeff, about when you might hire it or not. It may be a generous thing for you to say, yeah, I could fix my car if I had the time or if I liked to do it. And in your case, you might say, I just don't have time to. But it might be an opportunity where you say, you know, I'm going to go ahead and hire, if say you knew a guy, I'll go ahead and hire him. It'll give him an opportunity to do some productive work. I'll pay him. I don't really have time to do it anyway. You both win. It might be a good thing for you not to do the work. And similarly, if you knew you could hire some people off a network like that, you give them opportunity for work.
The Stillwater Care, the neighbors, just have that ability. Do they screen clients and find out?
I don't think they do right now, but they do maintain a whole network of what ministries are doing what. So they might be a good place to start. And I've done this before where I've contacted Quinn over there to say, is there anybody who does, you know, I've looked at their directory or trying to find out, is anybody doing this particular kind of thing? So I wonder if they either have somebody who's trying to facilitate that or if there's an opening to potentially start something that would facilitate a network of just, yeah, what would you call it, an informal labor or just kind of a people that would say, you know, there's utility work of different kinds, hauling firewood, doing whatever else.
I was thinking about it because one of my graduate students needed some firewood.
Okay.
And he has a chainsaw and stuff. When we went over to our property, we cut wood and carried it. We both filled up our pickup trucks. But if I could have hired somebody to help, we could have probably gotten a lot more.
Yeah, gotten it done.
Just to haul in the firewood, you know, up 50 yards from where we were cutting it to the truck.
Yeah. Well, this is something, and I should have been writing these down. We're going to continue this next week as we also think through some ideas and where they might be. I'm sure there are pitfalls. You know, I don't know at what point OSHA or somebody else wants to say, if you facilitate the network or you had the website and the guy just signed up, it was direct, you didn't do anything, and he goes and hurts his back while hauling firewood, and of course now he wants to sue the website or something that, you know, I don't know. The people who run the website, and there's probably some issue there, I'm guessing, but...
Well,
maybe there's a way to...
Nigeria, but okay.
There you go. There you go. And the last thing, I'll go ahead and close this in prayer here. Thank you very much. I'm not going to focus a lot on the last couple things on majority world, other than to say when it comes to help, which I think we're right now focused a lot on in the Stillwater area, which I like. I think it's good. I think there's a lot of ministry here. When it comes to partnering overseas, it's always good to remember the timetables they mentioned. I always remember how their notion of time is different. Everything from when they start church to when they end it might be different, and the time frame under which they expect certain results to happen. And this, they just highlighted again, and I was convicted by this, that North Americans tend to want to come in. We need these things going on. We want measurable objectives. And if I don't see that happening, I'll kind of take over here, because this just isn't moving. We need this to get moving. We need a driver. And that can often be a bad thing. A lot of these, we mistake it for lack of motivation, lack of drive, and it could be that in a lot of these cultures, I wonder if we've experienced this with our team in Sudan, probably. I'm assuming so. There's a different time frame. What appears to us as laziness or lack of motivation is not necessarily what that is. And we have to sometimes be patient in how these things go on. So that's all I'll say about that. Why don't I close this in prayer? Lord, how thankful we are for the study we've been working on here and these thoughts to help guide us. We again appeal to you for grace to know how best to help without hurting. We pray that you would help us as we continue thinking about needs in our community, things that gaps that may exist, things that we could be doing. We pray that you would help us to be doers of the word, not just hearers, but to be wise in that process as well. We pray that you would bless our worship today as well, that you'd be honored by it. And that we would be ministered even as we worship you, our great King and Savior. In Christ's name, amen.